century. Our eyes on the universe have been opened anew. We are witness to the very brink of time and space.
We must ask ourselves, we were so proud of our accomplishments. What is our place in the cosmic perspective of life? The cosmic perspective of
the
life.
Exploration of the cosmos is a voyage of self-discovery.
As long as there have been humans, we have searched our place in the cosmos.
Are there things about the universe that will be forever beyond our grasp? Are there things about the universe that are ungraspable?
One of the great revelations of space exploration is the image of the Earth, finite and alone, bearing the entire human species through the oceans of space and time.
Matter flows from place to place and momentarily comes together to be you. Some people find that thought disturbing. I find the reality thrilling.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
Hello, and this is Don, your philosopher, political science guy.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and lecturer to the public.
This is Daniel, economist and drowning in finals.
Drowning, eh?
Yes.
I don't have fond memories of being a student anymore.
Didn't you just graduate?
Yes, I did. Well, how did you guys' week go? Anything exciting happen?
Well, mostly I've been working on this talk that I'm giving later this week.
Well, we'll have to learn more about that later. What about...
Perhaps something on Friday night or Saturday night?
Oh, right. There was something about that. Who organized it? I think it...
That was me!
It was okay.
Ethan spent probably more time than he thought he would spending organizing these two debates with the co-sponsored by CFI and Reasons to Believe. They are debates against Hugh Ross, which is, as P.Z. Myers put it on a blog earlier today, an old Earth creationist.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. Reasons to Believe contacted us and said, hey, we got our president is going to be in the area. He's going to be talking about how you can prove the existence of God through science that apparently exists in the Bible. And we said, well, he's either going to come here and say it unopposed, or we can set up a debate and give a counter opinion, which is exactly what we did. And... very successful. We had a lot of people show up, more so than I thought would even bother to come out.
The debate that I went to, the first one with Rob Tarswell here at UBC, was packed.
It was probably over 300 people.
Oh, I would say closer to 400.
Yeah, closer to 400.
I mean, the room would seat about 500. We had that place about 80% full. Mm. It was very surprising. But I thought a very interesting debate. I don't think anyone was really surprised by what Hugh Ross had to say.
I was there for the first one, not for the second one. I was so, so disappointed. I mean, as far as an event organizers go, hands off to Ethan and all those who helped set it up. But, I mean, it was the same old claptrap, you know, and it was worse than old Earth creationist, because it was pseudoscience as well. I mean, he took scientific principles and he manipulated them to make it support a thesis that really had no foundation. And although Rob did his best to defend the scientific method and reason, this guy, I mean, he spent more time trying to pawn off his books and videotapes than he did any real education.
Yeah, when I was leaving the debate room, outside there are these two tables, one with Jamie Williams sitting behind it with the CFI booth, and he had a couple of issues of Free Inquiry and some pamphlets. And then there's other table from Reasons to Believe, and it was full, you know, completely full of books and tapes and DVDs and stuff, all featuring Hugh Ross and his theories and Reasons to Believe.
Atheists need better merchandising skills.
Well, you know, actually, I'm quite surprised they haven't been pegged by the CBC, because I noticed their videos are called Rough Cuts. And isn't that like a documentary show on CBC called Rough Cuts?
I'm not sure it's called.
Well, they are an American organization. They probably get a free pass on that one. However, on Saturday, we had sort of the sequel debate, which was entitled What's Right and What's Wrong with Christianity, with Brian Lynchahan from the UBC Freethinkers debating Hugh Ross.
And this one took place in the 10th Avenue Church, where presumably there were more believers in the audience than atheist students like at UBC.
Well, yeah, most of the questions, though, were, I think, from a skeptic point of view. But it was quite excellent, I have to say. Much more structured like a debate as opposed to a lecture followed by a sales pitch for books. Brian did a very good job, I think, of coming across with a lot of gravitas and very succinct and very clear on what he was trying to say. He didn't necessarily try to counter what Hugh Ross was saying because, again, he didn't know ahead of time what Hugh Ross was going to say, but he had a very strong argument for things like morals without God and, you know, how Christianity, or not just Christianity, really any organized religion that requires the suspension of, you know, relying on empirical evidence is dangerous, and that it makes you uniquely vulnerable to people like, you know, Peter Popoff and faith healers of all sorts, right?
One thing that kind of annoyed me about the second debate, which I didn't actually go to, but there were some videos posted online from what I've heard, Hugh Ross basically gave the same talk, modified a little bit, as he did for the other one, despite it being about, like, the morality of Christianity.
I
understand in the debate part it might have been different, but in the his actual, 20-30 minute
opening
thing, it seemed to be pretty much the same thing. Like, he seemed to be ignoring the question, which he did a lot.
Yeah. He did address a few things that were a bit different. He talked about, you know, the whole issue of the empty tomb of Jesus and all that sort of thing. But, yeah, it was very similar, which I don't think should be a surprise to anyone. But, again, I thought that the second debate was very well done, very intriguing, and I think the response was actually quite well from the audience. I think that where I was sitting, there was, I think I was probably in the heavily Christian area because I could hear a few mumbles of agreement whenever Hugh Ross spoke and grumblings whenever Brian spoke. So people seemed to enjoy it. And you know who else seemed to like it is PZ Myers.
Yes, he posted a commentary on it on the blog and linked to a post by a blog called The Communists Manifesto, written by someone who attended the debate and took some video footage of it. You can watch it.
I should add that we actually have a video of that as well, and it will be posted shortly on our CFI Canada YouTube channel.
Yeah, and just so if anyone wants to check out that blog, it's cromunist.wordpress.com.
We'll post it too.
Sure, why not?
I'm still saying, I'm going to ring up the other thing, is I still think it was a horrible waste of time. All we've done was give this guy, who quite frankly is a quack, I mean, he's a scientist, but he's not a scientist. And if you go through the things he said, they were all insane. And yet we gave him a platform to proselytize. And even though the majority of people...
he was going to have a platform anyway.
No, he wouldn't. I mean, we supported it. We told people to go out and see this guy.
Reasons to Believe is a well-funded organization. They were going to have a platform regardless. He would have just booked a room at UBC and put up posters and gone out there and said, like, you know, this is what scientists believe.
Like, I think that the more people that actually see what this guy has to say, the more people will realize that it's complete hokum.
But we right now, because of the way the debate worked, this guy come out, he said what he said. There was no real debate. So as Daniel was mentioning, he apparently didn't even talk about the debate topic. He just said, here's my sales pitch. Both evangelical as well as capitalist, but I don't know. We gave him. I mean, I don't think we should ignore him because you're right. I mean, he's sitting there, he's saying this crap. But to go back to the thing, this kind of debate. I mean, he brought up the same old boring arguments. There was nothing new in it. Why do we have to keep debating people who are quacks?
We don't have to keep debating them. But
keep in mind though that as skeptics, as people who are very familiar with their arguments, we're not going to be surprised by anything they say. But again, these debates are not necessarily for us. They're more for the general populace who maybe not has our skill set or our unique knowledge
or even our point of view. I mean, we want, like, there are people who don't know what the claims Hugh Ross is making, but they also don't know the claims against Hugh Ross. And so if we didn't say something, we didn't respond to Hugh Ross coming to town and just proselytizing, we would have missed an opportunity to inform the public about, hey, look, this is kind of crazy, and here's why.
But, again, I think you're right. We should confront them. But in a debate structure, there is that inherent thing where these somehow are put on equal standing. And you're right. Well, if we have our skill set, we sit there and say, well, obviously it's not. But for other people, they sit there and say, oh, well, this must be valid because they're actually arguing. There's a debate about it, where there is no debate about it. If there had have been something new here, if he had have actually, I mean, he came across as, well, what's it, scientific proof for God. It was Aristotle's prime mover argument. I mean, how new is that?
Yeah, but you're acting like everyone understands this already. Not everyone has heard these arguments before, so even if we bring it to a few new people, that's different. Even for me, I knew some basics of Dr. Hugh Ross's argument, but I've never really heard anyone try to fit Bible verses to science before. And as much as it didn't work, that is new for me. And as you're making it sound, like, there's no point for anyone skeptical to go to this. But
I think
not go to it. I mean, I think it would have been good if we were in the audience and we said, hey, listen, this isn't true. Hey, this isn't true. But when you give a debate, and the debate format's the thing that I'm talking about here, is you're giving them an equal platform where they don't deserve a platform. Should we have gone there? Sure, we should have gone there. Should we have made questions? Should we have told people? Yeah, great. You can't ignore them. Ignoring them is bad, too, and I'm not stating that. But it's that we're on equal footing thing that I don't know.
But nobody's going to agree to a debate where it's like, you know, one person gets tarred and feathered at the end of it. That's well, just not going to happen.
Do we know if the public opinion is, now after these debates, that they were, in fact, on equal footing? I mean, I don't know if we know that. I don't know if that happens after other debates. It seems like an assumption that we often make that to debate someone with a crazy idea is to place that idea on equal footing with your response. But do we have any evidence for that claim?
Well, I
don't know.
I've had this, you know, internal debate in my head many times. Specifically, Michael Shermer, who I don't always agree with, but most of the time I do, he's a great skeptic, he made quite a lot of news by debating Holocaust deniers. And to me, that's a little strange. Like, I don't know if I want to give people like that a platform for essentially spouting what is just pure racism. But Shermer felt that to ignore them is a greater risk. And he's made quite, you know, a lot of YouTube fans by debating people like Deepak Chopra and Holocaust deniers and creationists. And I'm pretty sure that he wrote in his books that debates will not change somebody's mind. 90% of the people who go into a debate have made up their mind already. They just want to see their side win. I mean, honestly, have you ever gone into a debate saying, I think I might be swayed by the creationist?
Well, I mean, polls coming out of many debates, often both sides think their side is won.
Yeah.
Well, also, too, then that actually rolls it down to not the value of the arguments presented, but how they're actually presented. I mean, let's face it. Hugh Ross has a very polished approach, and it looks very good. And if you're, as you guys keep pointing out, if you're not quite as up on the facts as obviously we all are, being university-type people, then you know, maybe you will be swayed just because he's got a fancier slideshow.
Well, it's possible. But I mean, I've heard things that, you know, fancy slideshows actually make it worse. But
I know Rob Tarswell, the debater against him for the first night, he had a really interesting way of presenting it that I've never seen before. And I personally think that probably actually helps sway some people towards the atheist side who might have been on the fence, if there were any there.
Well, and yeah, it
was entertaining, it was candid, it was different, it wasn't your standard slideshow.
And it wasn't in your face, you know, new atheism where it's like, I'm right, you're an idiot, and I'm right still, you know.
No, and I'm not criticizing Rob, I mean Dr. Rob, who did it. He did a very good job, and again, part of the thing was they were talking across purposes. I mean, one of the things that Rob kept saying is, I'm not saying that it's impossible, it's just there's no evidence to show that it's right. And like I say, they were talking, it was like probably with the second debate about ethics, whereas, you know, there was a question out there, but they were talking past each other. Because as you say, in a debate format, the important thing isn't to educate, it is to win. And that's all I'm going to say about debates.
Okay.
Now.
I think all that remains to be said is to ask the listeners and watchers of the debate what they thought. So if you're at the debate, send in your comments to radio.freethinker@gmail.com or watch the videos that we'll put up online and send in your comments on those.
Right. Why don't we go to a commercial break and we'll be back with some more on Radio Freethinker.
This is Kim.
And we're the Presets. You're listening to CITR on 101.9. That was
smooth. CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Well, there is one story that just won't go away, and that is the HST, which I believe stands for High Strength Tape.
Yeah, that was pre-thought out, wasn't it? You've been up all night working on that.
I was all up all night working on that. We discussed this... Geez, a couple months ago.
Yeah, we did a show on it in November. We did another little summary of it last time, I think.
Yeah, but and, 2 weeks ago.
And it's come up again. We get more email.
Every time we mention it, somebody emails us.
I think it's probably the most emails we've gotten for anything.
It's been very taxing.
Get out.
That same joke was made last episode, or... the other episode we did.
Well, if it's funny 300 times, it's got to be funny 301.
Right. Well, listeners, while we really appreciate you guys reaching out to us to solve your problems, we simply cannot keep devoting time to the HST. However, what we are going to do is we're going to post our show notes on our blog along with all the emails that we've been getting on this. And we encourage you guys to check it out, radiofreethinker.com, add your two cents, and let the conversation develop. Obviously, we encourage you guys to keep this in the realm of evidence and reason and not politics and social
ideology.
Class warfare, if possible.
By the way, if you don't want your email posted, please send an email to us saying that, you know, please don't.
We'll do what we can to keep it anonymous. You know, we're not going to post anyone's personal information or that sort of thing.
Also, I just want to point out one thing that we forgot to mention about HST, just one quick thing. A lot of people will be receiving checks from the government, if they haven't already, for, I think, $100 to $250.
Cha-ching!
One-time check.
It's a one-time check. In
well, of course
order
not.
To,
it's a regular check the government's going
to
pay you.
From PST to HST.
Is this somewhat like the gas tax thing that we had a little while back?
Sort of. It's basically because they're thinking of it, the government, is that people, a lower income family spends about $3,500 on food a year, according to their estimations. And so they're giving you the amount that you'd pay extra because of HST.
One, Ontario was $1,000, wasn't it? And two, is it after the first year poor people don't have to eat anymore?
I'm not going to hear this. Check the blog out.
Right. Speaking of taxes...
Well, have you guys heard of a small town called Gibson's in British Columbia?
I have.
I thought it was somewhere in the northern interior, but apparently it's on the Sunshine Coast, so...
Well, they're making headlines because they've done something very interesting. They are asking questions about who gets tax-exempt status. So, as most people know, in Canada, if you're a charity, you get tax-exempt status. And there are four categories of charities. There's one... the relief of poverty, two, the advancement of education, three, the advancement of religion, or four, other purposes beneficial to the community. That's how you be a charity in Canada.
That's on the federal level, if I believe, though. That's how you become an official charity, but that's not necessarily local governments aren't held to that for tax
inception. Well, and there would be a difference, too, between provincial and federal, right? I mean, because there's different levels of taxation. Mm-hmm. This Gibson one is municipal taxes.
Right, indeed. Mayor of Gibson's, Barry Yannick, felt the city should review the situation for the 2009-2010 tax year. And with limited resources, they said to the charities, prove you're a benefit to our community or you'll lose your tax exemption. And so, you know, they talked to the local charities and said, okay, well, we do community outreach. We rent out our hall. We fund, you know, clothing for the needy, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a perfectly reasonable way of determining who is actually useful to the community and therefore should continue receiving tax exemption.
However, one such church, Jehovah's Witness Hall, provided the following answer to that question. They said, our mission is to assist the local unincorporated association of Jehovah's Witnesses in carrying out their religious objective of preaching the good news of God's kingdom and promoting public religious worship. Now, how does that serve the community?
Clearly, they weren't very smart when they responded with that.
Well, but I mean, it was even better, right? Because didn't the mayor or whatever of Gibson say, well, how does that benefit the thing? And the response was, what is it? To assist any who attend these public meetings by means of moral or spiritual instruction based on God's word in the Bible.
So essentially, help us make more Jehovah Witnesses.
Yeah. They're getting tax exemption because they are spreading their meme.
Exactly. And Mayor Yannick is planning on telling the Jehovah Witnesses, do something concrete for the community or lose your tax status. And I think that's perfectly fair. And it goes without saying that CFI has been lobbying the government for a long time to review these laws. It is absolutely ridiculous that advancement of religion is a charitable cause. That is favoritism. And it's not all favoritism. It's specifically Catholic and Protestant schools. It's not even across the board religious education. It's just those two.
Actually, there's another thing, too, that was interesting in this reading it, is that other churches in the area said, well, you know, okay, we do the preaching thing, too, but we also have our halls open up for community services, and we have, you know, thrift shops, whatever, for poor people. So even though, I mean, just not the single Jehovah's Witness out, because they're proselytizing, all churches proselytize
sure.
in their own way, but they said, that's sort of our private thing. What do we do for the public, for anybody who wants to come, is we do these other things. But I have a question for you, Ethan.
Sure.
Being also double hat of CFI.
Mm-hmm.
So what if I was a religious person? I said, well, we're providing an educational thing, because CFI is
yeah.
not tax-free, right?
And we're an educational charity. See, I have no problem with a church being a charity, but it shouldn't be under the cause of advancement of religion, because that essentially means the government is funding advancement of religion, which in a liberal democracy like Canada is kind of, you know, a faux pas. Now, if they say, we're going to do education, we're going to set up a school for the blind, we're going to set up, you know, clothing for the homeless.
I think
that's perfectly legitimate
yeah, churches,
and fair.
Churches, if they do stuff for the public community, could very easily fit into that last of the four categories.
They could fit into any of them. Relief of poverty? Sure. Advancement of education? Sure. Beneficial to the community? Sure.
I want to play devil's advocate here, though. How is what CFI does fundamentally different? Aren't you, to some extent, proselytizing skepticism?
Well,
where is this line drawn? Is it your line that religion is wrong? There, not wrong, but incorrect. Therefore, it shouldn't count as an educational charity.
Well, we have, Canada has a so-so kind of wishy-washy law about church-state separation, but most liberal democracies do. They indicate that that's simply not in the realm of government to control, either through beneficial means like tax exemption or through, you know, negative enforcement like, you know, intense taxation. People should be free to worship however they feel, but they shouldn't get either favorable or disfavorable status because of a religious belief. Now, with CFI, we do education, and, you know, you can say, okay, well, isn't that also to a certain degree what churches are doing? And if they are, fine, but they shouldn't be falling under the status of both education and religious advancement. That's just silly.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you can expect something under the realm of education to be providing accurate and useful information. And it's arguable that the preaching that churches do is neither of those things. But, you know, if the church is doing something along the lines of providing public services to the community, any of the other categories, that's fine. But if all they're doing is preaching to the choir or trying to convert people, I can't
really
see how that's...
And remember, the roots of this are from, like, missionary work. Government spending money to send missionaries to countries to convert. People, you know... Canada has kind of a bad rep for that, you know.
See, for example, the Native American residential schools
exactly.
here in D.C.
You know,
well, actually, no, I'm going to correct your history here. I mean, religious schools started off because the only people who needed to read and write were priests. And then... maybe in Canada, you're right.
But the tax exemption status, I mean, originally the sort of the rule, the reason it's investment of religion is there in the laws is because it's supposed to be like funding missionary work, funding advancement of religion in terms of like converting people.
I think to go back to where we were going with this originally, we did a news bit, I think, last show about a private school, quote unquote, in the Okanagan or whatever teaches creationism in its science class, and because it's a religious school, but it's also a public. That's where they get that crossover between you can be religious or you can be educational, but you can't be religiously educational. I guess would be the.
Well, I mean, you can have a private religious school. That's fair game. But as soon as you start getting government funds, that's when you cross a line. And I think that it's not terribly, you know, political to say that's just not right. You shouldn't be taking taxpayer money to advance a religious cause that a good chunk of your taxpayers don't ascribe to.
What if the curriculum was mandated by this province? As in, you could only teach this, you can't teach that, but it's still a Catholic environment or...
Well, to a certain extent, they do. They have, like, a benchmark you have to hit. How you get to that benchmark is up to your school, I suppose, which is what's happening in the case of Kamloops. The school falls under, you know, the provincial standards in which their students have to have a certain knowledge of, you know, whatever, science, math, reading, that sort of thing. But how they get their students to that benchmark is completely up to them. So they can teach them creationism. They can teach them that 2 + 2 = 5. If they can pass a provincial exam... Then it's okay.
Perhaps an argument against the use of provincial exams and standardized testing, but...
Didn't we talk about that already, too?
There was another wrinkle to this that I thought was kind of interesting, because one of the other places that they're debating whether they're going to give tax exemption status...
It's a hard thing to say.
...is the Christensen Village, which apparently is a assisted living... seniors home, and although it's also done in association with the Lutheran Church, they had the issue with that wasn't because it was religion-based, but because there were people at this facility who were not local,
right,
and that they didn't think that they should be giving tax status to other people from different provinces. How does that add to our little wrinkle?
I haven't actually done a terrible amount of research on that particular case, but I recall there was something fuzzy about the province should be... Provincial government should be also funding that as well, but they weren't, or something like that. I admit I haven't done a lot of research on that particular case.
The biggest thing was that the mayor feels like their town is subsidizing the retirement of other people who are not of the community.
Right.
Oh, if they're living in a home in the village or town, whatever, I mean, they are living there, aren't they? I mean,
yeah, I guess it depends on if they're contributing or if they're just taking up resources. That's an interesting question. We'll have to investigate that further. Well, we've done this to death. What's new?
The usual assortment of neat science stories. I found one just today, actually. There's this show in the UK called Bang Goes the Theory, which promotes science and research in roughly the same way that Mythbusters does, with lots of colorful explosions and cool experiments. And one thing that they did was they decided to crowdsource some data about brain training games, things like so they set up a website and they spread information about it on the internet so that people could sign up online, and they received over 50,000 signups, and ultimately about 11,000 people completed the entire study, which is pretty freaking huge. I mean, if you have a sample size that large, you can you can be really, really strict about what data you choose to keep. Because, I mean, it is the internet. There's going to be people who are just going to start screwing around with the data. So you can afford to be really strict with it. And you still end up having a really large sample size. So what they did was they had people sign up, and they split them into three groups. One which did a bunch of brain training style games, like the sort of things you find in Brain Age or Big Brain Academy on the Wii, all those things. The second group had some general problem solving training games. And the third group just did trivia questions every once in a while. And they did this for, I believe, 3 weeks. And they compared their progress and their scores on these kinds of brain training tests at the beginning, at the end. And what they found was that, contrary to the implications of these brain training games marketing, they don't actually improve your cognitive function to a really significant extent. So they did a calculation about the memory task in particular, and they found that in order to be able to remember just one more digit in a series of digits, you'd have to do the brain training as the way they did it in the study for 4 straight years just to remember one extra digit. Wow. So ultimately they found that the brain training improved your functioning by about 3% as compared to the just completely all they do is trivia, 2% improvement on the same tests.
Are you suggesting that Nintendo is not being entirely honest about its video games?
It's not just Nintendo. Actually, like the next page I clicked on after viewing that report, which was on Ars Technica, we'll put that up in the show notes, I saw an ad for yet another brain training game by some online corporation. You see billboards for these everywhere. You see them on nearly every gaming system. And it's, you know, some of them don't go so far as to say this will improve your brain function in stuff.
I have a question,
life.
Rob. When they say improve your brain function, what exactly do they mean by that? Like,
it's really like such a vague term that you can never hold them to anything.
What on earth does that mean? Does it mean you're going to have more neurons firing? Is your brain going to get bigger?
They'll improve things like your memory capacity, your ability to do mental math, your ability to do spatial reasoning and rotations and things like that. But the problem and what this study found is that it only improves your performance in those specific domains. As far as they can tell, it doesn't really apply outside of the brain training game. So you'll get better at playing the game, for sure. But when you do something else that is related to that skill, you won't really show much of an improvement.
So basically, if I'm going to go on Jeopardy, I better start playing the home version of Jeopardy a lot, because that might actually help improve my score.
Yeah, like, you know, do trivia games. There's actually this one that I've turned on my roommates to, and hopefully now that people are listening to the radio show, they'll check it out. It's called Ring-A-Rang, and it's this thing that basically every hour in some random time, it pops up with a trivia question. And, you know, it's fun. You do these brain training games, you do trivia games because they're fun. And to expect them to improve your cognitive functioning outside of the realm of the game is optimistic at best.
What's the capital of Burkina Faso?
So Burkina Faso City.
No, Ouagadougou.
Does this mean if you're stupid now, you're stupid forever?
Well, presumably there are ways of improving your...
That was such a stupid question.
Well, I'm doomed.
Actually, you know, that reminds me of another study that I was listening to, because I don't read, I actually listen to everything, about how they were saying multitasking. I mean, there's been lots of studies that sort of say people suck at multitasking, but they did some brain imaging study or whatever that says that you actually might be able to bookmark a second thought while you're working on a first thought. Did you read that?
I remember seeing this. They basically found that you were able to sort of... when you're focusing your attention to something, you still have to focus it on one thing at a time. You can switch between two different things. But when you have two things that you're focusing on, your functioning is not as impaired as much as it would be if there were more things. There's a limited amount of resources for your attention. And you can switch between two things without your performance suffering too much. But any more than that, and you start sucking.
I wonder if they applied electrodes to you and increasingly shocked you whether you'd get better than that.
I wasn't listening to what you guys just said.
Don't drive while talking on the phone.
Let's go to commercial. We'll be back with more on Radio Freethinker.
class, shut up. Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So you were just telling me about an interesting story about an expedition.
Before the show, I just found a story about the infamous Donner Party. And for those unfamiliar with the story, it's the story of an expedition from through the Sierra Nevada mountains into California in 1846. And it was an expedition of a large number of people. I forget how many in particular. It was 90, maybe. But they were traveling through this mountain pass, and they got stuck in a really horrible winter blizzard. And they had to live at this one site in the mountains for the entire winter. And legend has it that as they started dropping off and they started running out of food because there was so much snow and they couldn't leave this one spot, they resorted to cannibalism. And it's passed into the stuff of legend. There's been, TV movies and short stories and all sorts of things about how the Donner Party resorted to cannibalism. And it was a stigma that stuck with the survivors of the expedition and their descendants for quite a long time. Well, in 2003, some anthropologists investigating the Donner Party campsite found the remains of their hearth, their fire that they, you know, must have created in order to survive. And they found bits of broken bone and materials and stuff around the hearth. So they gathered them up and they've been doing some analysis. And one thing that they were testing is to see if any of these bone fragments were human. And it turns out, now that they've finished them all up, none of them were human. There is no evidence to support the common idea that the Donner Party practiced cannibalism. And this is supported by the historical record. They kept journals and had documents, and the survivors all vehemently denied that cannibalism ever occurred. Some of them even defamation lawsuits. Thank you, Daniel. And so
you should play a game, too.
My brain just completely shut off there. But the point of this story, and the thing that I found interesting about it, is that we can look at common claims about history and still do science to check out and see whether they're true or not.
Really? So, like, I've been saying that for the past, like, year.
Well, this is why I brought it up before the show. It's just, like, illustration of your thesis.
But I'm curious about one thing, though. Was somebody missing? That's why they thought there was cannibalism. And if somebody had died from non-cannibalistic methods, wouldn't their body have been somewhere? I mean, did they find any graves there or anything? Maybe this was just a stage set by the people. You know,
always with the conspiracy theories, huh?
Got to have a good cover-up.
Well, I'm not sure how it got started. Possibly just through the spreading of rumor and some of the way that they wrote in their journals about how life was tough and they had to eat things they didn't want to, but never explicitly saying, you know, the corpses of their fallen comrades. Well, when they analyzed the bones, they found that they ate everything from a horse to cattle, even a dog. And the horse and the dog weren't ever mentioned in their journals. So it's likely that they didn't want to admit that they ate, you know, the family dog. And one other thing that they found there was that it seems like they were trying to maintain a semblance of civilization, even in this harsh environment where all sorts of things were going wrong. And they found broken china and shards of slate around the hearth, suggesting that they were still trying to have a cup of tea while they were in this horrible situation.
How many of them were there?
But we're not savages.
How many members 40, of the donor party?
47 made it out. I'm not sure how many were there initially.
Well, that's interesting. And they never found any graves or bodies of the people who didn't make it.
The story I read didn't mention that.
So that'd be sort of the ultimate piece of evidence.
The kicker?
If they found something with, like, teeth marks on it.
Or they didn't find any bones at all, as if someone had purposely tried to cover up.
Well, I mean, bones can be scattered. I mean, that does happen. But again, I'd be curious to see how this started. If this was just some, writer in San Francisco or, Los Angeles decided to,
We were talking how these things get started. We were talking the last show about the conspiracy theories around the death of the Polish prime minister, which, obviously enough, God has it in for the Polish people as well, because he created a volcano preventing anyone from flying in there to witness the funeral.
What a convenient story.
So do you think there was any discrimination involved when they were hacking up the people? Oh, right, they didn't hack up the people. But do you think there was discrimination because of that?
It's likely. I mean, it was the mid-1800s. Discrimination was pretty rampant in California at the time.
One of them became known as Heisbird the Cannibal to his neighbors.
Ouch. But I think I see where you're going with the discrimination thing. You're referring to a story that we've been trying to talk about on the show for at least the past 2 weeks, a story about kids with Williams syndrome.
Yeah, it was an article I was reading in Scientific America. Actually, there were a couple of articles, although they all seem to be interrelated, talking about the same thing, about a study that was done into racism, or perhaps a more appropriate term, otherism. And there's these people who have what's called Williams syndrome. Now, it's a malformation that has, among other things, defects or malformed brains. And one of the characteristics of this is that they have absolutely no social anxiety, or next to none at all. So they wanted to test out whether these people had racial or gender biases. They've done similar studies with children before, and they've found even very young children will have a prejudice towards people of their own skin color or stereotypical gender role bias. Now, what they did to do this thing, they grabbed 20 kids that had Williams syndrome, 20 kids without. All of them were supposedly about the same IQ, about the same social class, same home life or whatever. So they tried to eliminate as many of the confounding issues as they could. And they showed them two pictures. And they'd have one of a dark person and one of a white person. And all these kids apparently are Caucasian, which is, I'm not sure why, but so they showed one of a colored with one another, and they tell you a story about one of these people killed a dog and then fed it to bunnies, and they have to point out which one was that story about. And there was this, in normal people, average people, there's a strong bias towards your own color. So positive stories are my color, negative stories, people of a different color. Whereas Williams syndrome children had no bias. It was actually almost completely random as to which one they picked. Oddly enough, though, they still showed gender stereotypes. So if you said, who makes dinner around the house, Williams syndrome kids and other kids, non-syndrome kids, both would say mom makes it, or the female does this. And so they still had, again, the term they used was gender stereotype roles. Now, I thought that was kind of interesting, but a friend of mine actually banged me on this, and he says, I don't think that's true. I think the confounding issues are big ones, and actually, the article does talk about confounding issues for gender. They say, well, maybe there's something because we all have maternal instincts, which might be different than our social instincts. But he says, maybe these Williams syndrome, they have an inability to pick up on social cues, right? Some people have like autism and that, and they just can't perceive certain cues. So maybe they can't see racist cue or negative cues. So I did a little bit more research into it. And it turns out actually that autistic people are actually more, quote unquote, stereotypical than the rest of the population, specifically because they don't pick up on social cues, that they have to use this other modality to try and anticipate what people will do.
Well, you mentioned that the control was 20 and that the children with Williams syndrome was also 20 in number. Is that a large enough size to make any kind of make any kind of scientific statement about? Or is this maybe just too small of a group?
It's iffy. I mean, with that kind of study, it really depends on the strength of the effect. If you have a very strong effect, you don't need a lot of subjects in experimental and control conditions to get enough power for statistical significance to work.
Right.
If the effect isn't that strong, and if there's a lot of variability, a lot of error, then it's anybody's guess. And, you know, it's an interesting start. I think more research should be done.
Yeah, I'm looking at the graph that they have to show the difference. And, I mean, the graph-wise, as a percentage, it's about a 20% difference between the two groups. But then 20% only works out to be like 3 or 4 kids, that can throw off the numbers quite radically. So I agree. I think it's an interesting area for more research. And it just shows, you know, I mean, the one thing I got out of it is that there is sort of this genetic predisposition towards otherness, and how do we deal with that? Because some people sit there and they say, you know, well, things like races and all that is purely an aspect of cultural indoctrination. And this seems to show that although the manifestation of otherness might be that, there may actually be physical or evolutionary biases towards us. As we were talking about the God of the brain previously.
Well, when we think about racism, traditionally I think about it's more sort of based on perception of people having different views on things. For example, you know, we think about cultural racism, like you don't like the way somebody eats, what they eat for food, you don't like the way they dress, you don't like the you know, culture they come from, their religion, their ideology. Whereas I think otherness sort of, to me, sounds like, you know, I don't know what this person is about. I've never seen them before. They could hurt me, so I'm going to be very careful around them.
Well, you know, one of the things that really clicked in, I don't know if you guys have been listening to the news lately, but there's been a lot of discoveries about hominids. So when Homo sapiens were around, there were other things that were like us, but they weren't us. But they would have looked similar to us, but not the same. You know, Neanderthals, Homo habilis, the pygmies of the South Pacific or whatever, right?
The hobbit
people, that's the word I'm looking for. So I mean, in a way, this otherness, besides being, I don't know, there was a time where you needed to distinguish between humans and non-humans, even though they might be very, very similar.
Well, I mean, even today, like, suppose you're you know, mowing your lawn, and this strange creature comes out of the bushes, and it's got, you know, it looks like a cute, fuzzy bunny, but it's got this big scorpion-style tail. I mean, you're kind of going to go,
what?
That's interesting. I'm going to stand over here now. You know, I mean,
you'd call up what's his name and be like, look, this isn't a crocoduck, but it's close enough.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the differences, though, because you're right, I mean, pattern recognition and knowing difference. I think the difference here, though, is that you don't get the same otherness. You know, you don't get racism against dogs and cows. Right. So,
right.
I mean, so even though, you know, they are different animals, we don't tend to have a bias towards one or the other. Whereas, again, racism, culturalism, religionism. I mean, sometimes I might be offended of religionism because I tend to have a rather negative view of people who have religion, and that's my otherness factor, mm-hmm. or one of my otherness factors.
Yeah, from what I understand of how this works, there's research into this called the implicit association test, I think done out of Harvard Law and Mind. And what they do is they show you pictures of stereotypes of some sort, usually white people and black people, their faces, and they'll put up a word with a negative or positive connotation and ask you to associate it with one or the other. And in general, normal people who will swear up and down that they aren't racist at all will find it difficult cognitively to associate positive connotation words with negative stereotypes around their culture. So it'll take you longer to, you know, push the button that associates a positive word with the black guy, and a much shorter time for you to associate the positive word with the white guy.
Yes, you can do this yourself. We'll put up the link on the show notes.
Yeah, actually, and there's more to it. I mean, we're using the term racist here, racism and all that, but it just doesn't have to be color. I was having, again, another discussion with a friend of mine about discrimination, racism, that you had like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, whereas, you know, if you were French, then somehow the Germans were they were an inferior race. You know, I mean, not the Nazis or anything, but I mean, but they were all the same color. They were all white folk. Right? Yeah, but I mean, but the definition of otherness was different then. So now it tends to be far more skin tone related, although not necessarily. But again, that's just that is very culturally significant. Yeah, what the otherness, how it's exhibited, is extremely culturally relevant.
Well, I mean, once the otherness has been decided upon for your particular time and space, you'll notice things are other, and then it'll be easier for you to associate negative things with them, and it will be sort of feedback loop. And sometimes that will turn out into, you know, hardcore racism. But there are ways of mitigating it. There are other endpoints from the same feedback loop.
I've noticed, too, that throughout history, it tends to show up more when you're also trying to differentiate yourself in terms of how great you are, in terms of like a culture, race, country, whatever. So, you know, if you're British, you define how great you are by how much better you are than the French. And, you know, same with for the Germans and the Italians and whatever. It's there's sort of like a sort of flow chart of otherness, racism, nationalism, you know, religious persecution, sexism, all these different levels of ways that you can differentiate yourself by making yourself look so much better than somebody else.
Yeah, there's a whole hierarchy that is studied over many years by sociologists, anthropologists, psychologists, whoever, of in-group and out-group. And that's where this all links in.
Well, it's a very fascinating field.
Speaking of out-groups, you're going to be going out, aren't you, Rob, soon?
These segues are just... they're gold, people. You should write these down and remember them for all posterity. Yes, I am giving a lecture. It's sponsored by CFI. It's this Thursday, April 22nd at 7:30 at the SFU Harbor Center downtown. And it's called How the Brain Lies. And basically, I'm going to be talking a little about cognitive psychology. For the past, you know, more than a year, I've introduced myself as cognitive psychologist and something else on this show. It's time to focus on the cognitive psychology part.
Is this your way of telling us that you've been lying to us? I mean, can you really trust someone who's going to give a talk about lying?
Actually, it's interesting you should say that, but the talk won't actually focus on all that much on brain function because that's not the area that I study. There will be some mention of it in the studies that I talk about, and I'll try to tie it all in together. But it's less about how the brain lies and more about how the mind that arises from the brain makes errors in everyday judgments.
So are you saying that the mind and the brain are separate entities?
No. The mind is the result of what the brain does.
See, this is just maddeningly confusing. Your title is called The Brain Lies, but it's not really about a brain lying, so that's kind of a lie. And I'm just like,
everything he says is a lie. Well, I have some skeptical highlights, actually, if anyone doesn't mind. Tonight at 7:30 is a special event. It's going to be the first ever Skeptics in the Pub co-hosted by Café Scientifique. So it's going to be very interesting, probably very crowded, so please get there early to secure your seat.
So when you say co-hosted, does that mean one group seats you and the other group gets your beer? Is that like...
conceivably, yes. Yeah. What's going to happen is the evening will open, like a usual Café Sci will, with a thought-provoking talk and questions and drinking, and will turn into typical Skeptics in the Pub, and that is drinking and socializing and possibly eating some food. So I encourage you to go for the talk and learn something about immunology, which is the subject of tonight's talk, and stay for some beer and, you know, some skeptical socializing, which is always, I think, the great thing to do on a Tuesday night.
Cool. Should be interesting because there's probably some people that always only show up to either Cafe Sci or Skeptics in the Pub, and Never the Twain Shall Meet, as it were. And we'll see how the mixing works.
Of course, there is a problem with this, I just realized. Because, I mean, you're going to go to the Cafe Scientific, and that's going to help improve your brain function, much like games would. And then you're going to proceed to drink beer, which is going to kill all those brain cells that you've just exercised up.
Well, you know, it's you know, you have to weigh the balances. You know, you don't want to get too smart.
No one said reason was rational.
That's something I will endeavor to show you in my talk.
Speaking of weird things, I heard about this actually on the news. I was listening to Scientific America again. It's been my podcast of like this day, about NASA. Apparently, you know, everyone's heard that Obama has redirected the NASA mission or whatever, and there was a big fear that, you know, there's going to be big cuts in the budget, or people are going to lose their jobs or what have you. So what has NASA done? Well, apparently it's having to sell everything off. Well, sell off a bunch of memorabilia from the Apollo mission. Essentially, yeah. Actually, I think it was designed to be a PR stunt for, A, the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission, as well as the supposed return to the moon, which was part of the NASA mission up to about a month ago when, like I say, Obama recasted its mission. But some of the stuff there is quite interesting. Some of it's actually moon stuff, or at least has moon dust on it. One of the things I thought, and remember, this is going to sound expensive, but you have to take in mind the shipping charges involved in here, which are part of the price. One of the little things was a little card one of them had written up that says, you know, if this happens, do that, if this happens, do that. And it was taped to the outside of the suit, which means it has moon dust on it. And it's expected to sell for about $300,000. Are we going to pitch in to get that?
So it's a little card that has moon dust on it.
Well, and someone's writing and all that. But, you know, like I say, you have to realize it's traveled a long distance. It's gone over 700,000 kilometers, judging by my rough estimate, which really is only like 50 cents a kilometer. I mean, it's a real steal of a deal if you think about it.
You know what I like is that space ice cream you get it, like when you go to the planetarium.
Oh, yeah. the freeze-dried ice cream.
You
yeah.
know, that's so funny because I was listening again. They were talking about NASA's new space mission. And they said, you know, NASA, you know, the trip to the moon provided us with so much technology. They go, oh, like what? And the guy's standing, and you could tell that he was having a brain fart. He was going, Tang and ice, freeze-dried ice cream. it was hilarious. Ethan's comment.
Well, you know what? It's funny, though. Like, I mean, when you think about it, the Apollo missions, I mean, they went to the moon on a screwdriver. Like,
The computer
that we have here is more powerful than the NASA computer that sent them to the moon.
And this computer sucked sometimes.
Yeah, it really does, actually.
Hear that, CITR?
Please donate.
And, yeah, don't spend the fundraiser money on buying, you know, NASA memorabilia, because we have more powerful stuff here in the studio. Well, I guess we're kind of running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker.
I guess. This is where the brain lies, right? Because, you know, we're kind of wrapping this, but I'm looking at the clock, and the clock says we got like 3 minutes, which in radio time is like forever. But I don't know. Do we have anything else new to say?
I don't know. Do you guys have any questions about the talk I'm making? I don't know.
Well, there was something actually I wanted to throw out there, and I hope people will email us, and we get a ton of email. Don't say it, Rob. Usually I say that.
About the HST.
but there's two things, actually, I think might be interesting. Maybe not. One, I'd like to do a show, maybe next show, on Deepak Chopra. I'm butchering that name, right?
I think you're about right. He's coming to Vancouver, right?
He's coming in June 4th. And I'd like to do a bit about quantum healing and the whole misuse of scientific terms, which I think Hugh Ross did very well or horribly, depending on your perspective. But another thing I thought was interesting, and now I have to say that I believe in an environmentalist and all that, right? And there's been a lot of news, a lot of stuff in the news lately about the new dam that just been announced by the government.
This new hydroelectric thing that's going to span this massive length of...
And it's going to be really expensive and all that. But I was really surprised about all the environmental groups are coming out and they're saying, oh, this is terrible. We can't do this because you're gonna drown the whole valley and there's going to be a huge carbon. And then I was thinking to myself, and again, I think we need to get off of fossil fuels as soon as we possibly can. But the environment's essentially saying, we can't go to hydroelectric because you're going to destroy the valley, you're going to drown a valley. We can't use wind power because wind turbines kill birds. We can't have solar because that destroys grasslands by covering them up. We can't have nuclear power because of the waste. So does this mean these environments